Vermont was the first to abolish slavery, and last week took another position to expand the right to vote to a traditionally disenfranchised segment of our community. It's a move that will have enormous and immediate positive effects, and again, ensures Vermont's history of leading toward freedom. Our guest today is a powerful voice who has always advocated for diversity and freedom and unity, and is the first woman of color ever elected to the Vermont Senate. History is being made right here, once again, in this very brave little state. Glad you're with us. Greetings again from beautiful Vermont. We received such amazing and positive feedback from our first two episodes, and today's will certainly be one for the archives as well. Meg and I will be speaking with Senator Rahm, a powerful leader and a steady voice for progress, and I can't wait to get into the issues with her, particularly around the House and Senate's votes last week on voting rights. And we'll also be talking with Senator Rahm about how we can confront the clear and present health crisis of racism and racially motivated violence that's taking its toll throughout our nation. But more than anything, we're going to talk about solutions, how we move forward.
That's right. And, you know, to build a healthier Vermont and a healthier country, right? We must confront the systems and the policies that have resulted in injustice and in many members of our communities feeling like their voice doesn't matter and that they're not needed. And I think that over time, like the dismissal of those different views and experiences has really deprived us of talent, of vision, of ideas, of a really important historical knowledge base as we're talking about these issues today. And we saw in Vermont something extraordinary happen last week, which was the passing that would allow two municipalities to have non-citizens vote. And to me, that is so huge for two reasons. It's a double win. For one, it's allowing non-citizens to vote on local issues and letting them know we want them and we need their voice. And on the other hand, that wouldn't have gone to the legislature if the voters in those municipalities hadn't already overwhelmingly said, this is what we want for our community. So we've strengthened democracy in two ways. And we're going to talk about that and a lot of other stuff. But I'm just so excited to have Senator Rahm here with us as we look to kind of better understand the barriers and explore what we are doing and what we can do.
You know, that's exactly right. Better understanding. And as we lead toward solutions, that's why I'm so excited about this conversation. And just to set it up, a few facts that are certainly a little surprising, but set up and frame this conversation so perfectly. Let's look at the Vermont census from 2021. 94% white. A state that's 94% white, 1.4% Asian, and 1.3% Black and or African, according to the census. But Meg, as you and I know, those demographics do not in any way paint a truly accurate picture of our great state, a state with much more diversity than is reflected in these numbers, and therefore an extraordinary opportunity to lead in ensuring that radically diverse, racially diverse, socially diverse populations are protected and celebrated and that their voices are heard. That is what Vermont has always done. That is how Vermont has always led. And that is the way we are leading now. I mean, there's no question, as we know, that the challenges that exist for these communities are significant, regardless of the aspirations here in Vermont or around the country. People of color here in Vermont and nationally are significantly more likely to experience lower quality healthcare, for example. They are traditionally have less access to resources like education, and they are much more likely to experience prejudice in their professional and their personal lives. And in talking about this, and certainly with this conversation today, the problems, these challenges often affect the most vulnerable and newest of our Americans the most, our most recent immigrants. It's critical that people understand, and I've always looked at this, that immigration is a net good. It always has been. It always will be. It was when my grandparents came here, escaping Tsarist Russia, and it is today. It isn't just simply about all of the issues we hear about the problems in society. We should also be focusing on the realities of the benefit of this extraordinary diverse population here in Vermont and around the country. Just here in Vermont, very, very specifically, immigrant-owned businesses generated $30 million in business income a couple years ago. Those are the last time the data have been updated, and set over $60 million to state in taxes, and had over almost $500 million in spending power just here in Vermont alone. So diversity of people and ideas and races and experiences makes us all so much richer in every definition of that word. And today's conversation is about how we best ensure that all of our people are heard and heeded.
That's right. And, you know, I think what you just said, I really want our listeners to hear it and think about it. Like, yes, today we're talking with a person of color. Yes, there's a lot of work going on to increase the voices of new Americans and immigrants and refugees. But this diversity is so much bigger than that. And what we're really talking about is, how do we not just say there's a seat at the table, but create a seat at the table for people from different parts of the state, from different backgrounds, from different socioeconomic classes, and people of different races and colors too. We are so much stronger when we work together. And, you know, a really good friend of mine who works in the legislature told me, or said to me once, that we need to move legislation at the speed of trust. And that was such a simple and profound thing to say. And, you know, for me, I think we have to remember that it has been centuries that we've been telling people through our actions and through policies that they either aren't smart enough or don't deserve to be here. We don't need them. We have the plans. And we can't just say now, okay, everybody's welcome. We said you're welcome. If you're not here, that's your problem. We need to do this at the speed of trust, so that we can show people we want their voices engaged, we need to hear their ideas, and then we can work together. And that's why I am so excited that we're gonna get down to it, that we're gonna get into it now with our guest, Senator Keisha Rahm, because she has been doing this work in Vermont for so long with women's organizations, with different organizations of color, with different socioeconomic groups all around the state. And she's built that trust, and she's helping to build leadership there to prepare voices, different voices, not the same voices, to come to the table and to feel safe in sharing their ideas. And that is going to have a phenomenal impact on what we achieve here in Vermont. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Senator Keisha Rahm and to start this conversation with her and to get her ideas about how we move this forward and what it's going to mean.
Well, again, thank you so much, Senator Rahm, for being willing to have this conversation with Meg and me. This is an extraordinary topic, and such a broad topic, and our hope, as I know you know, and so many of the conversations you have, is that we won't just simply talk about what has been talked about over and over again, although obviously it's often critical to go backward before we can move forward. And our hope, really, as with all of these conversations, is to craft a set of thoughts and actions and agendas that can help us all move ahead. And the subjects that we're talking about today, I think for all of us, are very personal, and they obviously are very immediate within our nation, as they have been for so long, and as they will be. So that when we begin, I'd like to begin with you, Senator, in the same way that we began with Secretary Tebbets and with Chief Stevens, which were just extraordinary conversations. what has the last year taught you, if you will? What are the lessons that have come to you personally, professionally, and or personally over this past unbelievable year? And how do you take those lessons and move forward? What are the ways that you can look at this past year and figure out how does this inform our work and our actions and our thoughts moving forward? That's probably the best way to begin as we get into the conversation.
Well, thanks, David and Meg, for having me and for doing this podcast. I think it's really important to take stock of where we are and where we want to go. And I think that's been a lot of what I've tried to do this past year. I mean, as some folks may or may not know, I served in the House of Representatives in Vermont for 8 years, for my entire 20s. I went to grad school in between, took a break, went big and went home in the political realm for statewide office in 2016, and spent the last 4 years keeping my ear to the ground, trying to really do a lot of deep listening, because often in politics and elected office, we're expected to have all the answers. And I don't think in the reckoning we've been through politically, socially, and racially in the last several years, and I think culminating in a major way with a pandemic and the murder of George Floyd in the last year and a half, we don't have the answers. We really need to do a lot of listening in the community. And at the same time, I guess what I would say is that I went now to the state Senate, first woman of color, youngest woman in history to be serving in the state Senate. And a lot of my ideas have been bold before. They were so bold that I was, laughed out of the building or told that will never be a conversation we can have in the legislature. Things like reducing the use of suspension and expulsion on small children so we can limit the school to prison pipeline, even changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, introduced in 2011, environmental justice and linking our experience of our neighborhoods and environmental health to our income and our race. These are new conversations for a rural state like Vermont, even if I introduced legislation like this almost a decade ago. What has changed and propelled that legislation much further is that the national conversation is different, that my colleagues are not calling these ideas solutions in search of problems. We recognize that anything happening nationally is also happening in Vermont. We didn't have great data to tell us that story in the past. And so there was a constantly moving target. Well, what are people of color actually experiencing policing wise in Vermont? Or, what is the experience of kids in poverty, low-income kids, kids with disabilities, and BIPOC students in our schools? And now we have a lot of data to show Vermont is not exceptional. We have deep issues. We had experiences for Black Vermonters in the pandemic, for example, where they had 10 times the infection rate as white Vermonters at one point in the fall. These are huge disparities. And so no longer could we ignore what was happening. And as a lot of my friends of color have said too, after the murder of George Floyd, which I just hope we don't have to keep consuming Black pain and consuming media, like watching a Black man essentially, lynched before our eyes on national television over and over again, to feel the urge and the urgency to make change. But that sadly is what it took. And now no one can say, as my friends would say, they can't say they don't know, right? They know that this happens in America, over a counterfeit check or nothing at all. They know that Black men are disproportionately and unjustly murdered. They know that in Vermont, we're not immune from this experience. And so now what do we all do collectively with that knowledge? And how do we keep from getting exhausted before we've really made the changes that we need to make and really worked on this for our lifetimes of righting the original sins of this country in enslavement and Native American genocide and erasure?
One of the things you said that's so important, I think, for this conversation, both here in Vermont and nationally, about keeping your ear to the ground and listening. And I hope that you can start us by just helping us to pull everybody together, is Vermont is one of the whitest states in the nation. We know that. Folks like you, like I, and others have been saying all along, we're a community, we're all in it together. But can you talk a little bit about why this focus, these focuses on Black people's rights, Indigenous rights, diversity, inclusion, why are they fundamental to a state like Vermont or to our nation to address now? And how does lifting that boat lift all of our boats? Where are the connections?
Well, first of all, I would just say, you know, Vermont is not the whitest state in the country by accident, and it makes us all richer. It certainly helps the next generation, you know, including and particularly young white Vermonters. It makes them better and more whole as they enter the rest of society to know about racial differences, to have a good, comfortable language they can use to understand that and to understand the privileges that they may have. You know, you find that a lot of people, regardless of their race, struggle with the idea of moving to Vermont, you know, given how white it is. It's just a very challenging thing if you're trying to prepare your kids for the rest of the world to move to a state like this and to make the decision to raise kids here. There have been specific situations with white parents who've done transracial adoptions and are raising Black children in Vermont, where they feel really deeply at a loss to make sure that their kids have the experiences they need to feel affirmed and to grow up feeling safe. And then, you know, if we weren't just doing it because it's the right thing to do, you know, Vermont is aging. About 3% of our Vermonters over 65 identify as BIPOC, but it's 10% of our school kids. So if we're going to have a future, if they're going to say, I feel safe and welcome here, I see my path to stay, to go to college here, to raise my own family, to be a leader and to be part of this community professionally, we have work to do to make sure that our state, we don't continually to throw our hands up and say, we're so white. Why does this matter? It matters because we're so white, and it matters because we have a history in Vermont, went from fugitive slaves to Buffalo soldiers to this moment now, a lot of Black women particularly saying they're not safe serving in elected office, that when we try to change the culture and make it a little more open, there is an element that is ugly in Vermont that tries to push people out and away. And it is not the majority of people, but if the majority of people stay polite and silent and don't engage and think, it's divisive if I'm angry, it's divisive if I, you know, push back negatively, then they have not disrupted a status quo that's really broken for a lot of people who want to make Vermont their home. We have to evolve as a state demographically, and that is why I do what I do. And, you know, when we look around the state, many Vermonters want change. They want to have the answers and know what it looks like to feel welcoming. And that makes sense because 90% of our population growth in the last decade has come from the in-migration of people of color. Our communities know that to survive, they have to do better. And they don't have a great roadmap or blueprint. So it's a big reason why I do what I do, even if right now it's impacting a small proportion of the population. To link up with the rest of the country, we have to catch up pretty quickly.
You know, Senator Rahm, just following on that conversation, also something you said at the outset, which I think is so important and leads into some really powerful conversations. We have to make sure that exhaustion doesn't come before action. I think that's I think it's a critical thing to think about and to let percolate, because that's so much of the human experience. We get exhausted by pain or exhausted by chaos or exhausted by problems, and you just hope they'll go away. But in fact, that exhaustion, unless it turns into action, nothing changes. And to the extent, again, that the U.S. was founded essentially in part on a premise of inequality. I use the sentence that you use very frequently. It's our original sin, if you will. I think we talk about that very, very often. And clearly, at its heart, racism has been and always will be essentially a manifestation of the desire to appropriate, to essentially to take what others have, whether that's labor or power or land or money or what have you, to amass resources or power that could be in the hands of others. And obviously, and this really relates again to that question of looking back before we look forward. Obviously, in our nation, much has changed over two centuries, but it actually seems that we're devolving not only into a more structurally unequal society in terms of race, but we're almost devolving into a sectarian society. And that word has a lot of important meaning, a sectarian society where politics and culture is used and is thought of almost like religion, meaning that we're pitting people against each other and races against each other and individual states against each other. That sectarian philosophy, I believe, is one of the most dangerous sets of paradigms we have to deconstruct. And so if we're truly going to have an effect at all on outcomes, we obviously need to change course. We need to change paradigms. And so that understanding of historicity, the understanding of where we are, and your phrase that we cannot just simply look and think and be exhausted, but we have to move forward. How do we change that paradigm? Again, we're not going to solve that now, but if we don't change the paradigm, we continue to be exhausted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so first of all, you know, you named it as a sectarian divide, but it's cultural almost to the point of becoming religious, how divided we are in this country. So, you know, just knowing little facts like, you know, in 30 plus years ago, if you were going to marry someone of a different political party, you know, most parents would be okay with that, right? Their kids marrying someone of a different political party. Over half of Americans now say they would not be okay with their kids marrying someone of a different political party. Now, I'm Jewish and Hindu, and we've had a lot of ethnic conflict in my family's history. And I had some uncomfortable conversations in the past about, you know, in the U.S., who is okay to marry, who's not okay to marry. I never thought in this country we would have a conversation like that where so many Americans were uncomfortable because of someone's political affiliation with the idea of loving that person. You know, I have very different politics than my fiance, who I'm getting married to in just about a month. And it feels, thank you. You know, he grew up on a dairy farm in Charlotte. You know, I moved here from Los Angeles and feel like I'm living the Vermont dream of, you know, finding my little piece of rural countryside and finding someone I love who has a real connection to the land here, getting his grandmother's, you know, ring as my engagement ring. I mean, it's lovely. I love this state, and the state has welcomed me so much. And, you know, we have to recognize that it shouldn't feel like such a radical and courageous act to love someone who disagrees with you a little bit politically, you know? And there are times when it's hard for me to stay curious and to keep asking questions, you know, of his French Canadian family who, you know, grew up in the Northeast Kingdom speaking French until high school, you know, and knowing that we have a lot of that cultural diversity here, but trying to wonder, is it going to constantly be the American experience to traumatize new immigrants, right? Like, there's a lot of recent immigrants to the country who feel like, well, we went through this, so other immigrants have to go through it as well. Why is that the American story? Why can't we just question the foundation of so many of our assumptions about, you know, what it means to be to fight your way into this country or into a state or into a family, where love is really at the core of a lot of that? Speaking of love, you know, I think that's the biggest way to combat exhaustion. You know, I think too, it's important to remember most BIPOC folks, and particularly Black Americans, they don't have the privilege of getting exhausted and giving up. And that doesn't mean that they simply run themselves into the ground. It means they have a lot of coping mechanisms and tools to pace the change and to acknowledge disappointment and defeat without letting that become ultimate failure. What I worry about with a lot of white folks who are coming into efforts like racial and social justice, you know, is that they want instant gratification of some kind as though we haven't always had to fight for freedom in every generation, as Coretta Scott King would say. This is not new for us to, you know, fight for something and take steps backwards. You know, what this is a whole science, right, around the repertoire of contention and what protest and activism looks like in this country. And the people who have continued to tirelessly carry the burden, and I think carry a lot of those lessons as far as they can, are Black Americans, right? And that is so much the point of the 1619 Project and a lot of, you know, efforts to introduce racial education, is to acknowledge that these movements have always been here. They've always been refining themselves. And you, and if you're coming into the work and getting exhausted, you need to figure out how to extend outward and, you know, pace the change, accept small victories, you know, and recognize that this is a generational fight that has to be constantly had. That's been the message lately of a lot of my graduation speeches, you know, to and sort of coming of age speeches to young people who are coming out of a pandemic, rightfully demanding real change, systemic change, paradigm shifting change. What I want them to recognize is that that won't always make them popular. That doesn't always mean you get a lot of likes on Facebook or retweets on Twitter. You know, when, like, I try to remind them, when Bernie Sanders was fighting for just Burlington to look different and more livable, for Church Street to be a walkable, you know, downtown, he wasn't carried out on people's shoulders. You know, he was fighting. He was fighting a lot of people who disagreed with him. And even now, you know, people look at me and say, wow, Keisha's accomplishing so much. You know, she's passing all this legislation. People are, you know, listening to her on racial justice. I had to care about racial justice when people were not listening to me and people were not on my side fighting for these things. So, you know, you can't only be fighting for things when it's popular and when it feels, you know, like you have a lot of people at your back and social media is supporting you. You're not going to get carried out on anybody's shoulders when you do the really hard things, you know? And so people just, you know, need to not be fragile and not be exhausted. And that doesn't mean just pull yourself up. It means figure out ways to build resilient strength and connection so that you can tag out. You can, you know, stop, you know, playing a tape in your head that says you're not good enough, because you need, everyone needs to take care of themselves and rely on friends and still try and love themselves and one another through the really big changes we're talking about making. You know, that's important.
Senator Rahm, just to pick up on something, and again, I knew this was a conversation, I think for all of us, this is a real one. This is a meta conversation. This is also very personal. You talked about your Jewish Hindu roots. I think, you know, my family is Jewish, Methodist, Fiji Indian, Ethiopian. Right. We are here in Vermont in many ways because of that. We're here in many ways, as you said, because of the contention of love, right? Not only the love for each other, but the love that we have been able to craft and create and see. And we never, at least personally, and I know that you don't either, forget that the study of history, the study of what has happened, is the only thing that allows us to figure out how to move ahead personally or professionally. And I just finished a book I would recommend everybody reading. It was recently published, The Dead Are Arising, a new study of Malcolm X by Les Payne. It was actually his work for three decades, 30 years. The book was just finished by his daughter after Les Payne passed away. And the reason it's critical is that it sets up a set of contradictions and a set of conversations that allows us all to see right now, as you say, these conversations have all happened before. I mean, every single one of them has happened before. However, to your point, I think we're now at a place where what hasn't happened before, what even Les Payne or his daughter would argue, is that everyone knows the realities. We're no longer in a world where you can be truly insulated from these realities. So to the extent that we practice the love that you're talking about, or practice the study of what has happened so that we can move ahead, I think I think you're right. That's the way to avoid exhaustion, because that's also the way to not only plan our way forward, but to figure out how our way forward is good for all of us and how all of the voices that we need to hear matter. That's, I think, the way that we take the history and move it into the future.
Right. Well, and, you know, I just to add on to some of what you said, which was lovely. And yes, a lot of us are, you know, Hindus who grew up in an Irish pub, or, you know, Bengali North Dakotans who found our way here because, you know, we're seen as individuals in rural parts of America. You know, we are this, there is a lot that rural America has to teach to our urban communities as well about what it means to be seen in your humanity. And it's something we need to continue to work on and talk about, you know, in our rural communities. You know, what I would say, though, is that we're at a really interesting time when people can also pick and choose the information that they consume. And they can pick and choose from a lot of options. And they can actually avoid dissonance in a way that benefits, you know, corporations and the things they're trying to sell us. You know, that benefits large news and media conglomerates who really want to compete for our full attention and allegiance in some cases. And so, you know, I think that is the fight, a pretty unique fight of our generation, is we have so much information that we can really decide, you know, what we take in as consumers. And that is a fright, that's frightening, you know, but at the same time, it's very exciting because there has often only been one choice, and it's been the lens of a white male professor or a white male news anchor, you know, who everyone quote unquote trusts and, you know, listens to, and they digest the nightly news and what's important. That's left a lot of people out for a long time. So the reality that we have platforms and tools where we can, you know, democratically in some cases decide what information to elevate, what's relevant and important, is exciting. If you aren't careful with those algorithms and those kinds of feeds that you have, they are just reinforcing your worldview. So I often tell that to young people as well. And actually, it's not just young people, it's a lot of older people, frankly, too, where they all of a sudden, you know, you'll look up and say, man, Van Morrison is like a member of QAnon now, you know, like what happened? And it's really sad to think, like, you know, a lot of people have been cloistered at home, not expanding their worldview, talking to only people they chose to talk to through Zoom, or maybe they weren't even privileged enough to have tools to talk to others. So they've just been consuming TV, internet, you know, in their own bubble. That's made us a more disconnected world. We're going to have to fight really hard to hear each other again. And that's not just the work of some people on a certain side of the political spectrum. On every side of our political spectrum, you hear people wanting to stop talking to people they disagree with and not having the tools or the language to have a discourse beyond, you know, their particular perspective. It could be MSNBC, it could be Fox News, it could be CNN, it could be, you know, just consuming nightly news in your local community. But you have to question those stories and who shaped them and whose stories are missing on a lot of different fronts. And that is, it's exhausting, but it's going to be even more important coming out of a pandemic.
And I do think that like plays into what David was talking about, or we were talking about around sectarianism and how you mentioned like people being uncomfortable with someone getting married from a different political party. And I challenge all people, those who think that they're very progressive and open-minded, those who pride themselves in just following one source, to say, find some position that you are uncomfortable with and consume it in some way. Only for yourself. Only for yourself to understand what's out there. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons both of you have found a home and love in Vermont, and a reason I love Vermont, is because of our community. And we certainly are imperfect here. We see acts of racism, you know, we say, oh, we're nobody's racist here. We see blatant acts of racism happening daily here. We see blatant acts of homophobia, transphobia happening daily here. Right. On the other hand, we have these communities that get enraged about it and come out to try and protect and lift and support the people who are being hurt by that. So I think, you know, we all need to really dig into the human aspect of our humanity. What do we love about Vermont? Why did people come here? We love community. We love bringing our neighbor a pie and saying welcome here. So I think that that will help us. And I wanted to kind of play on something that you were talking about, burnout, and just something I have to remind myself of. And I think particularly, and you mentioned this, like white progressive activists, that we are here because of systems. That's why it's called systemic racism. So we can't, unlike many of the things we solve in our lives, right? Like as a CEO or a director of a nonprofit or a board, you identify the problem and then you create the solution. In this problem, there's not an easy fix like that. Systemic problems were created over time and triggered other problems, oftentimes, had an impact that no one saw and no one thought about when they first passed the legislation that looked really great on one end. And so we have to take the pressure off ourselves, and we have to say systemic change is change that happens both within our laws and within our communities and within our families. And it's going to happen in a combined way. So I was hoping that you could maybe talk a little bit about the Bright Leadership Institute, which you helped to get going. And, I find that such an inspiring organization because it is welcoming more voices and more people sort of where they're at, as opposed to just going up to people and saying, hey, your skin's dark, will you run for office? So I was just wondering if you could, just tell a little bit about how that started and some of what you've accomplished this year in terms of laying the groundwork for more diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, thanks for raising Bright Leadership Institute. It is a very, very bright spot in my work right now. And first, I would just say, a little bit to your longer point about systems change. In my professional work, helping organizations with hard systems change, especially around equity and, hearing and supporting other voices, I think it's borrowed from an academic paper, so I'm not going to cite them properly now, but I didn't come up with this. Systems change is dislodging the conditions that hold a problem in place. And so really starting to think about what are the conditions that are leading to this problem. Some might call that root cause analysis or a number of other things, but if you just sort of look at a problem and then jump to action, you're missing a lot of what keeps that problem calcified the way it is, which is the culture and a lot of organizational hardening, et cetera. And so, when I think one thing that really tipped this for me, I love, a lot of civic engagement processes that really bring a lot of unheard voices to the table. Been really a big fan of Susanna Davis and Taisha Green and a lot of the other folks who are putting data and science behind how we build equity in our communities. And Taisha Green, Skylar Nash, the folks in Burlington doing this work, we had a session that was just BIPOC folks in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, it was one of the first times I had just seen a lot of Black and Brown faces on one screen in a long time. It was really healing. And we had, there was a really open opportunity in different groups, large groups, small groups, specific affinity groups, et cetera, to come up with ideas for how to make change in Burlington and what identify the problems and then identify solutions. I tend to think of myself as very biased and kind of nerdy about running for office as one of those solutions, to fixing these problems. But across the board, the most popular solution from a big cross-section of folks that were not politicians, didn't think of politics as the most important thing in the community, they all said we need different representation for any of these things to change. And it's something I've lived in the Senate where there's no amount of storytelling or data sharing that you can do to transfer your lived experience as a person of color to a white body person in 5 minutes in a hearing or even an hour-long conversation or whatever the case may be. It's very hard for those of us with really different lived experience to be so far at the margins of power and decision making. And, I just try to explain this to a lot of folks is like what we constantly see and rail against with 8 white men in a room making decisions about women's health. I mean, my gosh, if you haven't had these reproductive organs, how on earth could you be making these decisions? I mean, what does that look like? And similarly, although we like to talk about race as skin deep, there's a whole set of other cultural markers and non-monolithic experiences for, you know, different Asian American communities, different Latinx communities, different Black communities, Black folks who, you know, have a history as descendants of slaves, Black folks who just moved here from Somalia. I mean, we're not monolithic communities. And if you can't even intersect with all of that difference from a place of understanding, it's going to take you much longer on your life horizon to be the best representative you can. And right now we don't have time for that level of work to happen for white folks. I think that many of them are getting there, you know, but nothing can replace lived experience as a person of color. So that all said, you know, when this conversation was happening around the state, and I want to give credit to Stefan Gillum, Tabitha Moore, Mia Schultz, a lot of people who helped build the NAACP chapters in Southern Vermont, who were saying, we need time to develop our own leadership and capacity ourselves, how we want to do it too, right? Like our leadership development is going to look really different. And that's been a gift even for me to see. And all of that was happening while a lot of organizations were spending money and resources on themselves, right? On their own journey in equity and understanding how to dismantle white supremacy. That is really important, but we needed a few of those financially, you know, well-endowed organizations to say, how do we just get money to the people who are under-resourced who have the answers? And, you know, so a friend of mine, Yael Friedman, and, you know, incredible Jewish woman who I think is still heading up the Northfield Savings Bank Foundation, but she was at the time that they were doing the regular grant making. And they do grant making in the community all the time. And for, you know, on racial justice, there was this kind of sentiment in the group, let's use the money to look at our own racial journey and what we need as white people. And she said, absolutely not. When have we looked at an issue like poverty and said, let's all spend the money on ourselves? You know, so on racism, why, you know, we need to look for the organizations that are doing this work in Vermont that are led by people of color. I'm just really grateful that she said that, that people listened in Northfield Savings Bank, because I think it's an incredible story that ultimately resulted in, you know, Yael having conversations with organizations like the NAACP, Association for Africans Living in Vermont, Migrant Justice, and others doing great work and giving many of those organizations $100,000 for whatever project they deemed was the thing that was going to propel people of color forward, for people of color, by people of color. And I just have to say that out loud because so much of philanthropy doesn't work this way. And it's all about, well, how many underrepresented people did you meet with, et cetera? Just give the money to the underrepresented people so that they're not exhausted by the change work, you know, and they're compensated and not depleted further. So one of the most meaningful, you know, 20-minute conversations I've ever had led to $100,000 for the NAACP to start this leadership not just start the program, but to fund the program. And Bright Leadership Institute comes from Luvenia Dorsey Bright, who was the first Black woman to serve in the legislature from South Burlington. And honestly, if you hold onto the outcomes too tightly as a white organization, and you say it has to look this way and we have to do this way, we probably never would have gotten to the point where I could call Bill Bright, Luvenia's son, and say, we're naming an organization after your mother, who has almost been lost to history and to time. We're naming an organization for your mother who struggled, who could barely talk about being a Black woman the same time she was trying to engage in educational reform and all kinds of changes in Vermont. And, you know, her family, you know, grew up watching that. Other people grew up knowing her story just a little bit. So to name this organization for her is an outcome that no one could have predicted when we started, but that a little bit of money and a little bit of time and attention has created a program in her name that is currently training 11 people around the state who are, you know, anywhere from really recent immigrants to the country to the descendants of slaves, you know, who've been dealing with generational trauma, you know, who have been some women been sending their kids out of state to run for office because they don't feel safe, you know, to Black men who feel completely marginalized from all these conversations and unsafe speaking up at all. You know, to people who are just figuring this all out because they have an immigrant experience and don't know what it means in this country to be treated as a Black or brown American. And it's just an incredible group of people, some who've run for office, some who are new to this, some who want to be leaders in different ways than political office, which is my bias, but a lot of whom are thinking about or have run for office. And it's, I just know this group is going to change Vermont permanently and for the better. And they are committed to being here, but they need support to do this safely. It is so depleting to be a person of color swimming against the tide like this in Vermont. It's not just depleting, it's unsafe in many contexts. Even I, when I go after, you know, policing issues or other major issues that are lightning rods, I start to get those emails. We're gonna drive you out of the state. Go back where you came from. We're gonna give you something to call the police about. Very veiled threats, like what Kaya Morris went through in a much more explicit way, what Tabitha Moore has been through. So what Lisa Ryan has been through as the first Black woman to serve on the Rutland Board of Aldermen. So we are having this experience where we have to think about the safety and resourcing and affordability of people of color being able to run for office. I think one of the big differences in our program, even if it's never enough, is that what Northfield Savings Bank gave us was enough money so that we could pay people to do this training. And I feel like even that is some kind of bold idea or, you know, a radical act to say, yes, sure, it's a privilege for us to train you and for you to be in this network. That doesn't mean it's the kind of privilege that you should be able to pay for to participate. Because it would be a gift and a privilege to have you serve. And if being able to afford something like this right now is not in the cards for you, that shouldn't be the limiting factor for you to use your voice. If you want to give your time and energy, and we're giving you a little bit of money to pay for childcare, to pay for lost income, to just pay for the expense of being, for example, a Black person in Vermont, just more expensive, where you're going to make sure you can get your hair done, how you're going to keep yourself safe, do you need security cameras? That all costs money for Black people in Vermont. So I often try to remind people, you know, whatever you're doing, if you look at a Black woman next to you doing the same thing, she had to deal with 10 times more to be able to be side by side with you. She had to make sure her kids were safe and getting the right education in school. She had to make sure she had somewhere to get her hair, nails, and makeup done. She had to make sure that her car could get her here and that no one was going to pull her over. All of this is very expensive and depleting. So if a person of color is willing to run for office, they need far more resources. We're not trying to teach them how to scrap their way to the top. We're trying to teach them that they deserve abundance and that they can get there and they can talk about it that way. And I think just that alone has been an incredible sea change for what's coming in Vermont's leadership.
You know, Senator Rahm, we'll put up, I mean, that's an extraordinary conversation that obviously requires a lot more depth of understanding. We'll put up a link to the Bright Leadership Institute. I think that we could have, and I made a note here, we could have an entire podcast about philanthropy. That has been, I've been a part of public-private partnerships, creating them certainly here in Vermont and all over the globe my whole career. And I have thought about, written about, spoken so much about how we need to move away from a philanthropy of noblesse oblige. We have to move away from philanthropy of noble obligation and more to a philanthropy of, you know, let's figure out what you need by you telling what you need,
right,
and then we solve that problem, as opposed to, let me tell you what you need, which has never in the history of humanity worked out well, and especially has not worked out well within marginalized communities or for people that truly have unique, definable, very clear needs. And that really, to wrap this together, as your role as a senator from the great state of Vermont, what are the digested, the distilled policy initiatives? Again, assuming you could create, pass, sign, understanding there's a significant political process, but what are the policy initiatives that would be first on your agenda to deal with some of what we've talked about over this incredible conversation that obviously needs to continue? What would be those things you would do that really could, in some ways, move us forward?
Absolutely. And, you know, this has been my kind of working hypothesis. So I feel like there's a lot of like nerdy, wonky people who listen to this. So I would just start with a kind of nerdy, wonky statement, which is when you're in any role, you have to know how you actually make an impact in your role, right? And that sounds kind of simple, but legislators will throw a lot of stuff at the wall and then think, you know, I don't know if I had an impact. I don't know if that really made a difference to the people that I wanted to make a difference for. We have to do better at knowing that first. And, you know, first that takes really good data and really good civil and civic engagement processes to check in with people. Did this make a difference for you? Often that takes paying people to come to the table, which we haven't done, right? Just when you think about boards and commissions in the state, which we have thousands of people serving on boards and commissions. Well, who is that? And if you're just getting $50 for, you know, coming out to Montpelier for a board meeting, who's able to participate? So just who's at the table in government is something I'm constantly trying to change in the background. When I think about policy that legislators advance and how it makes a difference, there are three areas that I think are really critical to us actually having an impact. One is changing the criminal code. You know, when you look at, you know, victims and survivors of sexual and domestic violence on the one hand and the way the system is broken for them, but also who ends up in jail, who ends up over-criminalized, and how the system's broken for them. We're often not healing, we're not having a healing system for anyone. We're over-criminalizing certain behavior. We're under-supporting, you know, victims of real crime. We're not putting the resources where they really need to go. And I think a lot of groups are saying that with one voice. I have a lot of legislation on the table that I'm going to put on the table that has to do with a policing and judicial system that works for those who are most marginalized. And that can be anything from looking at what I think Connecticut just passed to saying, why are we charging people for phone calls to their family from prison? You know, to why do we still think it's okay to lie to people to coerce a confession and believe that that confession is sound in order to put someone in jail? To how do we investigate use of force by the police in a way that's independent and actually feels meaningful to the community that was harmed by the impact of that? So all of that has to do with a criminal code that heavily impacts Vermonters and that we need to fix. The second thing I would say is advancing a civil right. We only get a few moments to do that in our work, but those are the moments that I think, you know, just mean the most selfishly. And we can see the sea change. We can see the difference that's made in a generation, right? I mean, you know, many of us who were there for marriage equality in 2009 before the rest of the country can now look at this continuum from kids coming to the legislature to say, this will change how I'm treated in the locker room. This will change the stigma around what it means to be gay. And to being able to go, you know, just a couple of weeks ago to Hinesburg, to the CVU, you know, area school district, to have a huge pride celebration for the first time led by young people in Hinesburg. I mean, for many of us to see that difference in 10 years is one of the most meaningful experiences we'll ever have, to know that so many people made that change possible, but that we had this really critical role to advance a bill when it took courage and to say yes or no when it cost some people their political careers, their seats, whether it was civil unions or marriage equality. But we knew fundamentally we would be on the right side of history and it was the right thing to do. We don't often get moments like that, but you know, even just this year advancing the constitutional changes around enshrining abortion and really condemning our history of slavery and not sort of acting like we never participated or benefited in our history, those were important steps forward. You know, so we have moments where we get to talk about our civil rights. I'm doing that right now with a much more comprehensive, kind of more challenging, complex bill to understand around environmental justice and health. But your environmental experience as a civil right is something that we really need to talk about, and especially coming out of a pandemic, where how healthy people were in their home and what transportation they had access to and what fresh food they had access to, we have to talk about as a civil rights issue when your environmental experience is killing you instead of making you better, when it is harming children and giving them lead poisoning instead of helping them get ready for school. And so, you know, that's a much larger bill that, and Vermont has not been part of that conversation nationally and really needs to. And the final piece, you know, probably I would say the most important, because none of these things really can happen without it, is changing something in the budget, is actually putting money where your values are and making the budget a moral document and a moral compass. What we pay attention to grows, you know, as Adrienne Marie Brown would say, where we put our resources, that's what we're watering in our community. Are we watering corrections over higher education? Are we watering, you know, policing over mental health and, you know, supports in our community? Are we watering, you know, kind of the the nuts and bolts of what we do in government, but not the relationships that we foster. And how do we, and to me, what that means is getting money out into communities to have difficult conversations, coming out of a pandemic, coming through a racial reckoning. What happens often, I think, is we forget about local government and we forget that money needs to get to the communities where they don't have a lot of resources to have a big conversation about policing reform or social justice. And so the same communities that have a bigger budget get to have that conversation, and the communities that don't, about opioids, about, you know, a lot of intersections of criminality or social justice, they don't get to have those conversations because there's no money for them. So it's something Susanna Davis, our racial equity director, is looking at as well. But we can't kind of hoard all this money at the state level when we know our communities are on the front lines of major paradigm shifts. And so, you know, I don't know how specific that is. You know, I have lots of specific bills, but often what matters the most is that you follow the budget. You know, the last thing I'll talk about is when it comes to environmental justice and young people, me too, the areas I care a lot about, I want us to be part of a civilian climate corps. You know, I want us to think about when we think about our budget, the best people you can invest in are the youngest. It's the early childhood education. It's the young people who are looking for their first job. It's the people who are, you know, not plugged in yet. And if we don't plug them in, they fall offline. We lose them. We lose them to apathy, to opioids, you know, to not feeling like this state has their back, because we can't always get that from their parents, you know, or from their families if they're lower income. So we need to invest in the infrastructure so that young people have adults and purpose in order to figure out their path here. And I know Bernie's been all about it. You know, I've been talking to our federal delegation and our local folks, but I think a civilian climate corps and just thinking about how we take people who otherwise are not, they live in mobile home communities, they live in, you know, large refugee communities, they live in affordable housing complexes. How do we give them a job in the green economy of the future? I feel like it's where a lot of these things start to intersect.
Wow, wow, wow. I was supposed to ask you, or I was thinking about asking you, you know, as the only woman of color serving in the Senate, like, where was your voice most influential? But I think you've really answered that question and answered why we need the Bright Leadership Institute, why we need diverse voices, diverse lived experiences, diverse perspectives. And Senator Rahm, what an amazing conversation. I do not know how you personally do it with your fingers on all of those different lenses and different groups, but I, for one, am extremely grateful for the time that you've taken with us here today. I'm completely inspired and see that we have a lot of work left to do together.
I echo Meg's comments. This is obviously a conversation, a dialogue that needs to continue and will continue among us and obviously among everyone. I really, in terms of what you've just articulated, I think it's very profound to think about that very simple statement, what you water grows, right? I mean, we talk a lot about agriculture, right? Well, that related to the budget is exactly the same. What you water grows. And I would really like to delve into later on in a subsequent conversation the idea of a moral compass, a budget being a moral compass. That's a profoundly interesting conversation that'll have economic, social, political, policy ramifications, but I want everyone to just think again about that very simple, metaphorical language that you use, Senator Rahm. What you water grows. Let's make sure we're watering what we want to grow. So thank you. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for the time. Thank you for the work you're doing. And we look forward to many, many more of these conversations.
Yes. Well, and thank you both. I mean, we have bold ideas in Vermont, but, you know, people don't always get to hear them until we have our big, you know, national figures like Bernie. But there's so much of us, there's so many of us here making a difference and, you know, trying to see each other's humanity. And we have a lot to share with the country and the world. So I appreciate that you're helping us do that.
Super. Thank you. Stay cool and we'll see you soon.
Well, Meg, I know both of us know that was a profound conversation and one that certainly will be able to be part of so much of the conversations that we have going forward. So thanks again to Senator Rahm for being part of this and for sharing so much of her time and the work that she's doing. We really look forward to our next guest. We're now we are gathering just a remarkable group of Vermonters together. Bill Schubart is our next guest, someone who has been writing for years and years and years. So many people in Vermont read his articles on a regular basis. He has thoughts about so much and will be a really remarkable person to help pull together a few of the threads that we have begun to pull on over these last three podcasts. So look forward to being back with Bill in just a few days.
And we look forward to being back with all of you listeners. And if you have been listening to us, particularly if you're an Apple user, please give us a rating and share your comments so we can be sure to integrate your voices into these conversations as well. Subscribe to the show wherever you're listening. Hit follow on Spotify, or you can go old school and send us some questions at ideas@boldideaspod.com. We really enjoy our time with you. We thank you for listening, and we want to remind you to think boldly. Until next time.